I walked in today to services here, it seems to be the conversation that's on everybody's lips. The news, of course, of Brexit and the implications that that has for us. It hasn't been lost on the commentators and the news, at least not since Friday, when I woke up on Thursday knowing the significance of the referendum that was taking place in Britain. I turned on the news to try and find anything, and of course the U.S. news cycle was all about the sit-ins, the Democratic sit-ins in Congress, and there was nothing I could find anywhere on any of the main U.S. news channels that would indicate that there was anything going on in England or in Britain. England and Britain are not the same, and if that's confusing to you, well, it is to most people, but in any case, the news cycle changed drastically on Friday when news came out that the United Kingdom actually did vote to exit the European Union. The significance of that has been bandied around dramatically by virtually all commentators, political commentators, economic commentators, and so on. Are you familiar with the Motley Fool? How many of you know what the Motley Fool is? Not too many. Okay, it's an investment advisor. The Motley Fool is an investment advisory service, and pretty well known and fairly well respected, but they sent out a message on late Thursday, a special message to all Motley Fool members from the chief investment officer of the Motley Fool. Of course, they give recommendations on investments to all of their members, and so everybody wants to know now, because the markets have been tremendously impacted all around the world by this decision of Britain. So they sent out this message. June the 24th, 2016. Dear fools, you know it's an interesting business market model when you can call your members fools and get away with it, but the Motley Fool members are known as the fools. Dear fools, it was a simple question with a ton of weight behind it. Should the United Kingdom leave the European Union? And yesterday, more than 30 million citizens of the UK surprised most of the world by answering yes in a 52% to 48% vote. What was once thought of as unlikely, if not impossible, they wouldn't actually leave, would they? It became reality, and investors around the world reacted swiftly. In England, the benchmark FTSE, their stock market in England, is down 4%. Germany's is down 7%. Now futures for the S&P 500 are off about 3%. Those numbers increased since the time that this was written. They say hedge fund managers, traders, and speculators are heading for the hills, or trying to, in the face of economic and political uncertainty. What does this mean for the future of the EU, our largest trading partner? A lot of people don't realize that the EU is indeed America's largest trading partner. They are. Will other countries leave? Is another recession on the horizon? The questions are unending. The answers are unclear. So now what? They say, keep calm and invest on. Keep calm and invest on. Today and the days ahead, they say, we'll probably see extreme movements in stock prices, and that's certainly been the case. Don't let your emotions get the better of you. Don't overreact. Well, this advice from the Motley Fool investment advisors is probably good advice for us as well. Don't let our emotions get the better of us. Don't overreact. Keep calm. We can say that, and yet we also realize that what we have witnessed is a pretty significant turn of events, prophetically speaking, that is not to be lost on us in terms of its implications and what we're looking forward to. What we're seeing is a dramatic development. And we see that, don't we? We recognize that, don't we? We're living in a time, remarkably, of fulfilled prophecy. It's not every day that we wake up and we can say, yep, there was a prophecy that just got fulfilled. Well, we could do that on Thursday or on Friday when we woke up. See, the church has been saying for many years, based on our understanding of biblical prophecy from Daniel to Revelation, that there will be a final resurrection of a European superpower in the model of the Holy Roman Empire, referred to in Scripture variously as the King of the North and as the Beast. And that will develop before the return of Jesus Christ. And it will exercise great power and great authority throughout the world, economically and militarily. And in the years following World War II, we have been watching a very slow but constant development as countries in Europe have been uniting into an economic and a political union that today has grown to encompass 28 nations. Well, it'll still be 28 nations for at least the next couple of years because England has voted to leave, Britain has voted to leave, but they are still members for the next 2 years. Once they're out, it'll be down to 27 nations. That's assuming others don't follow suit and also choose to exit the European Union. But the Revelation tells us that it won't be a conglomerate of 28 nations that will make up this final power that we're looking forward to. Revelation says that there will be 10 kings that give their power to the beast, indicating 10 nations or 10 groups of nations that will make up that final beast power, not 28. So if there are 28 now, guess what? We have to see someone leave, don't we? Somehow. Well, we've just seen one leave. Now, there might be others leaving, there might be others adding before the final configuration of 10 takes place. But we know that it's ultimately going to be 10, not 28. This beast power that has been prophesied is going to rule during a time, we read in the Scripture, that is called the time of Jacob's trouble. What is Jacob's trouble? That's when the modern nations that are descended from the tribes of Israel, of Ephraim and Manasseh, those tribes upon whom the name of Israel was designated, Jacob, those tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh now at the end of this age, we recognize from history as well as tradition, as well as the blessings that were given to them as recorded in Genesis, we recognize and understand that those are the British and the English-speaking peoples today. And this beast power will exercise its authority during a time known as Jacob's trouble. It will be a time when Ephraim and Manasseh, the British and English-speaking peoples, are in trouble. Obviously, then, not a part of this ruling great beast power. So when it was that the United Kingdom joined what was then known as the EEC, or the European Economic Community, back in 1973, after two failed attempts, by the way, the UK wanted to join the EEC on two occasions prior to 1973. And both times, the president of the EEC at that time, Charles de Gaulle of France, declined their acceptance. He said that they were too different. There were too many problems with accepting the UK into the community. It was until 1973 that they were accepted into the EEC. But from the time that the UK joined what was then the EEC, what has now become the EU, the church said that they would not stay in that body. We knew that they would not be in that final configuration of nations that were forming, that were becoming this European-based superpower. Now, the EEC in 1973 was not yet anything near as powerful as what it has become. But we saw it taking place. And when the UK joined it, we said they're not going to stay. We knew that. How did we know that? We knew that from prophecy. And so, as of Thursday, when they decided not to stay, guess what? We just witnessed prophecy being fulfilled. That's not every day you wake up and say, I just saw prophecy fulfilled. But we have, haven't we? The church has been saying since 1973 that Britain would not remain in the EU and that the final configuration of this powerful super state would be altered to be composed of 10 nations or 10 kings, heads of nations, that would ultimately make up this power. You know, it's an interesting thing when you look at the history. The UK joined the EEC for economic reasons. It was to their advantage economically to be able to trade openly with the nations of Europe. And so it was an economically motivated motivation that they had. But that wasn't the ultimate goal of those who were shaping and forming the uniting Europe at that time. I would like to read from one of our articles that you can find on Life, Hope, and Truth. This one is entitled A New Battle of Britain. It was written by Neil Hugberg. And in the section, A Different Vision for Europe, he writes this. Euroskeptics, and it is the Euroskeptics that were the ones in the United Kingdom that voted exit, Euroskeptics mourn the loss of freedoms and impositions of burdensome EU economic rulings. But this has all been by design toward an ever closer union. The great concerns of those that voted for Brexit were that there was more and more oversight and control being exercised from Brussels so that members of the UK were losing their sovereignty. They didn't have control. They didn't have say over what was to happen in the UK anymore, and they didn't feel it was in their best interest to allow this growing bureaucracy from Brussels to control things. They didn't like that imposition of burdensome EU rulings being thrust upon them. That was one of the major major concerns. But the architects and visionaries of the European Union, according to Jeremy Rifkin, author of The European Dream, had a strategy, and this is a quote, to move incrementally with technical and economic measures designed to increasingly bring member states together in a seamless, interdependent, commercial web of relationships. Each small step of economic integration would result in a slight, sometimes imperceptible, erosion of their national sovereignty. Britain said, we don't want any more erosion of our national sovereignty. We want our national sovereignty intact. And so 52% voted to leave the EU, largely motivated for that reason, as well as a couple of other significant ones. But the designers of this growing European Union had in mind, using the economic interweaving of relationships, to build almost imperceptibly, step by step, including an imperceptible erosion of national sovereignty. And this quote continues, none of the steps alone, they figured, would be enough to arouse the ire of member states and threaten the furtherance of the union. But the upshot of this piecemeal strategy would be that one day the national governments would awaken to find themselves enmeshed in a spreading web of international activities and agencies from which they would find it almost impossible to extricate themselves. You see, the designers of what we see as the European Union have not had just in mind, oh, let's have trade agreements. They have always had in mind to build a network that would tightly weave the countries of Europe together into a single block, not just economically, but politically as well, surrendering even their national sovereignties along the way to this larger bloc. Now, that's an amazing recognition and admission. But that has long been their design. That has long been their aim. And Britain has now said, we don't want that. We wanted to participate for economic reasons, not all of these other ones. We don't want that kind of union. That's not in our best interest. That's not in our sovereign interest. And so they've chosen to exit. But that is the design of the powerful organizers of this growing European community. And it has been for many, many years. Now, the Catholic Church has also had its designs on a growing unity throughout Europe. In another one of our articles, this one is The Brexit Debate, Britain versus the European Dream, under the heading Reviving the Roots, our author writes, in addition to political leaders, Catholic leaders have been urging a European political union based on Europe's Christian roots. For decades, they've been advocating this. Based on Europe's Christian roots. And by Christian, of course, they mean what? Catholic. In 1975, Pope Paul VI, addressing the bishops of Europe, said, "Can it not be said that it is faith, the Christian faith, the Catholic faith, that made Europe? And it is there that our mission as bishops in Europe takes on a gripping perspective. No other human force in Europe can render the service that is confided to us, promoters of the faith, to reawaken Europe's Christian soul where its unity is rooted." The Catholic Church sees European unity as rooted in its Christian history, its Christian faith, i.e. Catholic faith. He went on to say that the Catholic faith was the secret of Europe's identity, and when the secret was discovered, Europe could carry out the providential service to which God is still calling it. Pope John Paul II said, "I, Bishop of Rome and Pastor of the Universal Church, send to you, age-old Europe, a cry full of love. Return to yourself. Be yourself again. Discover your origins. Revive your roots. Revive those authentic values that made your history glorious and your presence beneficial among the other continents." This quote was later used by Pope Benedict, the current pope, to urge Europe to return to its Christian roots. So political leaders throughout Europe for years have been trying to work to unite Europe, not solely economically, but politically as well. Catholic leaders have been looking at this and saying, yes, it needs to be, but it needs to be united on the basis of its Christian faith. They've all been working for European unity. A stronger, powerfully knit together bloc within the continent of Europe in the mold of the Holy Roman Empire. Charlemagne, even today, is looked upon as the father of modern Europe and the inspiration of modern Europe. Pope Benedict said his predecessor launched the project of a Europe conscious of its own spiritual unity based on the foundation of Christian values. He expressed the desire for a Europe without borders, which does not disavow the Christian roots from which it sprang and does not renounce the authentic humanism of Christ's gospel. How timely this appeal still is in the light of the recent events of the European continent. These are the words of Pope Benedict. Pope Francis echoed the same message to Europe in a 2015 interview with a Portuguese radio station. He said, "Europe has to fulfill its role, that is, to recover its identity. True, Europe made a mistake when it chose to speak of its identity without wanting to recognize the deepest level of its identity, its Christian roots. That was a mistake. But, well, we all make mistakes in life. It's time to recover its faith." That's an interesting statement, isn't it? Pope Francis was the 2016 recipient of the Charlemagne Prize, an award given to individuals who do outstanding work toward European unity. The Pope was given that prize, the Charlemagne Prize. So there has long been this move toward a European Union, not solely based on economic reasons, but that has been the means by which the promoters, the developers, the visionaries of a united Europe have been working to produce this power. The United Kingdom finally said, no, we're done with that. Now, overwhelmingly, those that wanted to stay in the European Union in the referendum wanted to stay in for economic reasons. But overwhelmingly, those who voted to exit did so for reasons of sovereignty and security. British sovereignty, UK sovereignty and security. Well, we see now then the reasons why this has been happening. Why it is that the UK has indeed decided to leave this growing European power. We haven't been able in years past as a church to look forward and exactly say why it was going to happen, but we knew it would happen, didn't we? We prophesied that would be the case, that England would not be a part of this final beast power. And so it should not be a surprise to any of us that Britain has chosen to exit, that Britain has moved in the direction of Brexit. So now we see Britain exiting the European Union. And this is a step forward prophetically that we have been anticipating for a long time. Today, let's take a look at the potential impact that Brexit will have and at what we anticipate from prophecy are going to be the next developing stages to take place on the European stage. So you can title this message, if you like to title your sermon, Brexit and the Beast. The European Union today is, as we've already read, our largest trading partner, and the combined economic power of the EU is larger than that of the United States. A lot of people don't really realize that. America is still a dominant economic power around the world. And if the United States were to pull out of something economically, it would have huge impact. But the impact economically of the European Union is actually larger than that of the United States. According to Business Insider's Bob Bryan, Europe is bigger economically than the U.S., and he cites data from 2015. He says, as a single country, the U.S. is the biggest economy in the world. Now, China is challenging that on a number of fronts, but the U.S. is the biggest economy in the world, national economy in the world, but the adjusted GDP of the 28 EU member nations is bigger than both China and the United States. In U.S. dollar terms, the European Union accounted for 25.4% of world output in 2014. A quarter of the world's output was from the European Union in 2014. 25%. That's according to data from the International Monetary Fund. That was greater than America's share, which was 22.5%. And it was well in excess of China's share, which was 13.4%, said Joseph Quinlan, chief market strategist for U.S. Trust. Boy, if you just add that up, just between Europe and the United States, that's nearly 50%, 50% of the world's economy is found in those two blocks. That's pretty remarkable. With the European Union's contribution larger than America's. Now, continuing from Business Insider, it says the EU consumer is also on top. The EU accounted for 28.5% of all consumer spending in 2014, according to Quinlan. That's above the 26.6% spent by U.S. consumers and the 15.6% spent by the emerging economies of Brazil, Russia, India, and China combined. You take Brazil, Russia, India, and China, merge their economies together in terms of consumer spending, and that only adds up to 15.6%. All of those four emerging economies. Whereas the U.S. is 26.6%. That means you and me, consumers. That's how much we spent relative to the rest of the world. But the EU is even greater than that, 28.5%. So to put it simply, what are we saying here? If we just look at this objectively, what we're saying is that the EU is a massive economic power. More so, at least it was before the UK decided to leave, more so than the United States is an economic power able to influence world economy. And that EU economy impacts not just those countries of Europe that are the member nations and trading partners within the EU, but it does impact the world economy on a large scale, equal to or even exceeding that of the United States today. And there's no question but that the United States has been the dominant economy since World War II and is now superseded by the EU. Is that significant? We should recognize that it is. But the EU has some trouble. You know, you can stop and say, well, if they're more economically powerful than the U.S. is, why is it still that the U.S. has more influence around the world? Well, the EU has some trouble. Greece, Italy, Spain, their economies are in shambles. They're faltering economically. Germany is by far the strongest of the economies within the European Union, and therefore it has obvious leadership throughout the European Union. But the second largest economy in the EU, the second largest contributor to the economy in the EU is, guess who?
the United Kingdom, second after Germany. And now the United Kingdom is leaving the EU. What kind of an impact does it have when the second largest contributing economy to that union decides to leave? What's left? How do you handle that? Britain is now pulling out. You know, those integrated economies of all those 28 member states, and they are integrated economies. They function under the same economic rules and all of these things. They are woven together. The integrated economies of the EU are like a giant Jenga puzzle. Everybody know what a Jenga puzzle is? You build this wooden tower with all these different little pieces, and then individually people start taking turns pulling out pieces of the tower. And whoever is the unfortunate one to pull out the piece that causes the tower to fall, that's the loser. Well, the EU is this giant economic Jenga tower. There are 28 members that make up this Jenga tower. Now, if you were to take Greece, whose economy is pretty weak, and as a matter of fact, there were members of the EU that wanted to kick Greece out because they were in so much financial trouble. You know, if you take out the little piece of the Jenga tower that represents Greece, no big deal. But what do you do when you try to take out the pieces that form the second most powerful element of the tower? How do you take that out without crumbling the whole Jenga tower? That's what now is left for the European Union to try to figure out. How do you deal with that and still keep the Jenga tower standing? All of the little pieces of things that have been woven together and built over the last, 40 years. How do you start to pull those pieces apart? You can pull out a smaller piece that doesn't bear too much weight without endangering the tower. But how do you pull out a major block that's supporting the tower? That's a little bit trickier deal. UK now has a period of 2 years to negotiate their terms of exit. 2 years. To renegotiate on a national level rather than on a European level, but on a national UK level, with all of the other member states, how they're going to trade, how they're going to handle things like immigration and transportation and travel, and all of those things have to be renegotiated. There are economic issues that have to be renegotiated. There are political issues that have to be renegotiated. All of that's got to be figured out. Those that voted for Brexit did so because of concerns, as I mentioned earlier, primarily over two things. Immigration and border controls, security issues, and concerns about losing their sovereignty and their power to the control of an increasingly bureaucratic and centralized Eurocentric control in Brussels. They didn't want to lose their sovereignty to Brussels. There was an interesting interview on Thursday with the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. In the interview, to quote from the interview, Bolton said, I've never seen this referendum as primarily about economics. I think it's about self-government and sovereignty and security. Indeed, that's what the polling showed. He said, many political leaders in the European Union have always seen the EU as fundamentally a political project. And they believe that creating a European superstate would create an alternative pole in world affairs. Why would they need to create an alternative pole in world affairs? He said, in a multipolar world, there would be a Europe separate from the United States. I think that undercuts NATO. And I think that leads to a diminution of Western strength around the world. So Ambassador Bolton is looking at this from the perspective of the United Nations, or not the United Nations, but of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and Western power, especially as led by the United States. And the more there is a centralized power in Europe, the less there is of American influence. So that's what he has seen, this new pole being formed. He said if Britain leaves the EU, and of course now they have, if Britain leaves, the EU not only loses its second biggest economy, there will be a series of demands for referenda in plenty of other European countries. Now, this concern has been expressed by others as well. If Britain can leave, then will others choose to leave? Also not liking a lot of the onerous controls that Brussels has been putting on them. So perhaps others will be emboldened to follow suit. The EU will be fundamentally different, he says, in the future. Ambassador Bolton went on to say, and I think that will be better for the West. Whether it's better for the West or not has yet to be seen. He said this about this concept of Europe forming, he described it with interesting terms. He said this is a theology about the European Union. This whole idea about a Europe that is united and one is like a theology. It's like a religion to them. And the fact that Britain can leave threatens that theology. That's an interesting terminology used by the former ambassador of the United States to the UN. This is a theology about the European Union, and they see it threatened by this British vote. Regarding the influence that Britain would have if they stayed in the EU, which was one of the reasons that even our president gave about wanting and supporting the idea of Britain voting to stay in the EU. President Obama said, if you stay in, then you have a chance to exercise some control, some influence in the ruling and so on. Well, Mr. Bolton said the tabulation of 72 key issues over the years where Britain has differed from most of the EU nations, and the record of British success is that they're 0 and 72. 72 times there have been differences between what Britain wanted and what the rest of Europe wanted, and guess who won? Every single time it was the rest of Europe and not Britain. So that whole notion of Britain being able to influence is somewhat suspect when you look at the record of history. Mr. Bolton said it is a myth to think that Britain acts to influence the European Union. This is a super state under construction. It's largely a German super state because it reflects the dominant economy. And it's about this notion of super national governance. That's the admission and that's the assessment of the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton. Those are remarkable terms. It is a superstate. And the concept of forming this superstate is like a theology. It's almost like a religion that's driving them toward that goal, toward that objective. And it is a German-based superstate. So we're seeing the setting of the stage today for what is to come prophetically with the UK's exiting this growing power. Does it mean that the power is going to fall apart? There are people that say, oh, Britain leaves and that the whole thing will come tumbling down. There's not going to be a European Union. Well, prophetically, we say no. That's not what's going to happen. But it certainly might begin to force a new shaping of that European Union. It will move things more in the direction of what we see is prophesied. That's the more likely outcome. So we're seeing the setting of a stage for what is to come prophetically. We know that there's going to be a reorganization of the powers that will make up the beast. Brexit may just hasten that. There may be economic and political forces that pressure some left in the European Union to feel that stronger ties politically as well as economically and more direct controls are what will be necessary to keep the Union moving forward. Wouldn't that be an interesting outcome? Others might look at that and say, no, that's not what we want, and we want out. Or they might be forced out if they're not willing to go along with those that want those stronger ties. Can all of this maybe shake out to see the final formation of what we're looking for prophetically? In Daniel chapter 2, you know, the Bible's description of this end time power that we've been looking for is telling. And in Daniel chapter 2, and in verses 31 through 49, let's read here what is described in this vision of a statue that is given in Daniel chapter 2. Starting in verse 31, Daniel begins to interpret the dream that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, dreamt. He said, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and its arms of silver, and its belly and its thighs of bronze. Its legs were of iron, and its feet were partly of iron and partly of clay. And you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image of its feet of iron and clay, and it broke them to pieces." This miraculously carved out stone struck the image on its feet, on its toes, and broke them in pieces. "And then the iron and the clay and the bronze and the silver and the gold were all crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." We know what that stone is. That's the kingdom of God, led by Jesus Christ, who when he returns will indeed put down the final authority of man on this earth, and he will take rule to himself, and his kingdom will spread. And the kingdoms of men will be abandoned, and they'll be like chaff, spread, gone away, blown away. And the kingdom of God will remain. Daniel 2, verse 36, "This is the dream," he said. "Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king." He said, "You, O king, are king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, and then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth." And so after the Babylonian Empire, what came next? Well, it was the Persian Empire that came after Babylon. And then after the Persian Empire came the Greek Empire under Alexander and then Alexander's generals. So this is prophecy. This is history being written in advance, describing the flow of empires from the time of Babylon forward. Well, who came after Greece? Because that's only three, right? He said, "And a fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others." Well, after the Greek Empire came the Roman Empire, and it fulfilled this. It did this. "And whereas you saw the feet and the toes," so as you're going from the head down, you're seeing a chronological development, aren't we? And so when you get to the toes, that's the last, chronologically, the last part. And he said, "And when you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile." You know, iron and clay don't hold together very well. There's a fragility there and a tendency to break apart. And, well, guess what we're seeing? Isn't that exactly what we're seeing? There is a fragility within this European Union. There are those that want in because of the strength that it represents, and there are those that aren't able to stay or don't want to stay, like the UK in this case, and there will be others. It's partly weak and it's partly strong. There's an economy that's strong like Germany's, and there are economies that are weak like Greece's and Spain's. Isn't it amazing when you read in Daniel and you look at what we see today and we say, that's exactly what was prophesied. Exactly. What a fitting and apt description of what we see today. Verse 43 says, "And as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all those kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. In the days of those kings, this will happen. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. And then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face prostrate before Daniel and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. It's an interesting recognition here. But these feet and toes, this iron and clay, this partly weak and partly strong, is very descriptive of the European Union in many ways. It's descriptive of their cultures that have come together, where you have cultures that don't mix. Right now, I mean, look at, we've got France and Germany and the entry that are talking about Turkey. I mean, talk about cultures that don't mix. You've got economies that don't mix, partly weak, partly strong. You've got bickering between nations. France and Germany have had a historic bickering for centuries. De Gaulle wanted this union to take place to try and put an end to that bickering, to make it so that Germany and France couldn't be at each other's throats anymore, that they had to work together. That was part of the design. But it's still, they don't always agree and they bicker. Even France is talking about the possibility of a Frexit, an exit. So there are historic contentions there. Four empires of Daniel 2 that we just read correspond with the four beasts that are spoken of in Daniel chapter 7. And in Daniel chapter 7, which describes the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7 as different from all of the others. So we started with the head of gold in Daniel chapter 2, representative of Babylon, and so we have the first beast of Daniel 7, also representative of Babylon. But the fourth beast of Daniel 7 is described as different from all of the others that preceded them. Dreadful and terrible and exceedingly strong. It's described as having huge iron teeth. Interesting that Daniel 2 talks about iron mixed with clay, and in Daniel 7 we have iron teeth within this fourth beast. And it says that it had 10 horns. And it says there, as Daniel 7 describes this beast, that there was another horn. So there are 10 horns on the beast, but then there's this other horn, a little one that springs up among them, before whom three of the first horns fell, were plucked out by the roots. And then there in this small horn that grows up among them, it had eyes like the eyes of a man, and it spoke with a mouth that spoke pompous words. Well, what is this descriptive of? Historically, down through the ages, we can see, not so clearly from just this passage in Daniel 7, but when you combine it with what we read in Revelation as well, we see that these 10 horns represent not 10 concurrent kings, but 10 successive kings, or resurrections, if you will, of the Roman Empire. And the first three that were uprooted by this little horn historically were pagan-led uprisings, but powers of Rome. But then comes this little horn, the one with a pompous mouth and so on, which we know is representative of the papacy. Historically, we can correlate that. And then it rules with or alongside the remaining seven horns of that fourth beast. What then is described are the seven resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire, made or described as the Holy Roman Empire because of the association of the civil government of Rome with the religious power of that little horn. And so we see a historical development through time of these seven heads of the Holy Roman Empire, this fourth beast. So the first three were uprooted by the little horn. They were pagan resurrections, uprooted and supplanted by the alliance that was formed with the religious power of the little horn with the remaining seven horns. in other words, the Holy Roman Empire. We then go to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel, and remember what it was that the Pope, we read the Pope stated earlier about the historic underpinnings of Europe. Daniel chapter 11 gives us an incredibly detailed and very lengthy prophecy which introduces us to the king of the north and the king of the south. Now, they are not referred to as such prior to Daniel chapter 11, but in Daniel 11 we're introduced to these kings, the king of the north and the king of the south, and ultimately the fact that they will battle it out at the time of the end. And since we know that the prophecies of both Daniel 2 as well as Daniel 7 bring us right down to the time of the end, those last powers that are described in those chapters must also then correspond with the one that's described as the king of the north in Daniel chapter 11. So the king of the north has to be a power that is associated with this final resurrection of the Roman Empire. From our article on the king of the north, we read this. In Daniel 11, verse 40, we read of the king of the south attacking the king of the north at the time of the end. Now, this is a quote in our article, and we're quoting from the New King James Version. In the Old King James Version, in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, it uses the term, the king of the south will push at the king of the north. And if you do a word study, the word can be translated and can be properly understood as attack, but there's a strong sense of the word being not just an attack like we think of as two armies facing off at each other, but a pushing at, like what an ox does when he pushes with his horns. And I think that's a more apt description of what it is, actually, that this king of the south is going to do, because it's what we see taking place today. There is a pushing at, little attacks, but more like an irritating, constant coming back and pushing at and irritating the king of the north. So I think that sense comes across better actually in the Old King James translation than in the New King James translation. But anyway, getting back to the article, it says, we read of the king of the south attacking or pushing at the king of the north at the time of the end. And while the setting of this prophecy is quite clear, the time of the end, understanding who the kings represent is a little more complicated. To understand who these kings are, we need to consider the context of the extensive prophecy found in Daniel 11. The article then goes on to describe the historical background and development of the kings of the north and the kings of the south. And then we're ready to examine Daniel 11, verse 40. Back to the article, it says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack, and again I say push at him, and the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. So this nagging pushing at the king of the north will ultimately inspire a surprisingly rapid and ferocious response from the king of the north. It will be like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. And he shall also enter the glorious land, the Holy Land, and many countries shall be overthrown. Many countries will be overthrown. By whom? By the king of the north, when he comes back as a response to this attack or pushing from the king of the south. It says, many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand. Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Well, who are Edom and Moab and Ammon? That's the territory that we know today as Jordan. So Jordan will not be overtaken by this response. Now, if you stop and you think about this and you wonder, okay, who's the king of the south? Well, who can that be today? You know, the king of the south, historically speaking, was headquartered basically in Egypt, and it's a southern power. And who is that power? Who's among that power today? Well, we certainly would see where a lot of the terrorist activities are coming from would be counted in the south, certainly relative to the king of the north, which is European-based, right? So if we are to consider that the king of the south is a representation of what we see forming out of or alongside, let's call it something like ISIS. And what are they doing but constantly nagging and irritating and pushing out against and into Europe? Where have so many of the terrorist attacks taken place? We've seen them take place in Spain. We've seen them take place in France. We've seen them take place in other countries throughout Europe. And they're still going on. It's not just the United States that's being threatened by them, is it? Why is it that Jordan will not be included in this counterattack from the King of the North? Well, if we just look at what's happening today and ask the simple question, where are the terrorist groups not active today? They're active in Iraq, they're active in Syria, they're active in Lebanon, they're active in Egypt. But we don't see the terrorist groups headquartered in Jordan, do we? So if indeed these terrorist groups are in some way coalesced into this King of the South, and there is a ferocious response from the King of the North, why would they go into Jordan? They're not the ones that are creating the issues, are they? Now, isn't it interesting that we can kind of overlay what's described here in the Scripture with exactly what we see on the ground today? And that would seem to explain why Jordan, the territories of Ammon and Moab and Edom, would not be included in the response from the King of the North. At least that seems reasonable. I'm editing, I guess you can say, our article. These are my presumptions as we're moving forward here, but it certainly does seem to fit, doesn't it? Getting back to the article, it says the passage tells us that the King of the North, which will likely be a revival of the Roman Empire, the Fourth Kingdom, spoken of in Daniel 2 and 7, as well as in Revelation 17, will successfully counterattack the King of the South. Verses 41 through 43 indicate that in the process, he will enter the glorious land, the Holy Land, and that he will gain control over or have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. It's a remarkable thing that today, as the United States has got its influence within the Middle East, everybody's crying for the U.S. to leave the Middle East and, you know, all of these different things. There is going to be a power that will go in to the Middle East in an attempt to solve these problems, but it won't be the United States ultimately that does that. It will be the beast that does that. As for the identity, and back to the article again, as for the identity of the King of the South, the reign of the Ptolemaic rulers from Egypt came to an end long ago, and yet it appears that Egypt will once again either be the King of the South or will be aligned with other nations representing this power that will exist at the time of the end before Christ's return, verse 43. Why will the King of the South attack the King of the North to initiate this conflict at the end of the age? If we just replace a couple of the words here in the article with not just why will the King of the South attack, but how, and instead of attack, but push at, how will the King of the South push at the King of the North? Well, don't we see that taking place even today? Perhaps the article says it will be over economic disagreements. We certainly have those. Perhaps it will be over the treatment of Muslims in Europe. We certainly see that as a growing issue of concern, don't we? Perhaps, I'm going to editorialize again, it will be over these terrorist attacks that just seem to be escalating and becoming more and more of a concern throughout Europe for the citizens of Europe. Perhaps it's going to be exacerbated by the continuing rampant immigration problem that is dramatically reshaping the demographics of Europe today. The article continues, perhaps it will be a religious dispute because of the King of the North coming into the Middle East. Well, there are any number of things that could be contributing factors. And we see them, don't we? But there will be, what we do know is that there will be tension. There will be pushing at. And that it will cause, ultimately, a swift and dramatic reaction. Kind of crazy that all of those, even in Europe, that are upset with the United States, had our interventionist policies and treatment within the Middle East Well, their voices will eventually be snuffed out because that's exactly what's going to happen, ultimately, from Europe. We can see several forces at work today that are kind of moving in that direction. The economic impact of Brexit on the remaining EU states and the possible domino effect that it could have with other nations within the community may work, may pressure the remaining EU states to take stronger measures to strengthen their unity. The immigration crisis is certainly coercing some major changes in Europe right now. Demographics are shifting dramatically, and there are more and more cries for protection against terrorism and for controls over immigration, and against attempts to implement Sharia law in different locations, and against attempts to change the values and the morals of what has been a historically Christian Europe. Those are all threatened. So in addition to economic pressures that the Arab states might bring on Europe through, for example, oil policy, and that is still a major issue, potentially there are also growing security threats that will require an increasingly cooperative politically and increasingly military defense. At what point is it that the European Union will feel it can't trust any longer or rely any longer on U.S. policy and will feel that they need to take matters into their own hands? At what point is that? NATO is, you know, threatened, isn't it? Even Ambassador Bolton mentioned that. This other pole is going to form, and it's going to start taking more and more action on its own. Britain left the European community because of concerns primarily over immigration policy. They want to make their own policy without the influence of Brussels or Germany interfering. They feel that they have a better handle on controlling security within the United Kingdom without European influence. They want to make their own policy. But the immigration problem isn't only affecting the United Kingdom, is it? The immigration problem is also affecting the rest of Europe. And the terrorism problem isn't only affecting the United Kingdom, it's also affecting the rest of Europe. And those problems aren't going away. Realistically, what's going to make those issues go away? Is there anything that you and I can look at where we can say, oh yeah, if you just do this, then those problems will go away? Anybody have any ideas? Send them to the White House. They could use a few ideas. But they're not going away. Nobody in the White House, nobody in Brussels has any clue how to make them go away. They're trying, but they're not going away. They're going to increase. And if the United States and Britain prove unable or unwilling to deal with those growing problems, then eventually Europe will have to deal with it on their own, in whatever way they think is going to be appropriate. What other choice is there? It's not rocket science to look ahead and see that that's going to be necessary. But prophetically, we know that's going to have to happen. Scripture prophesied that. It's interesting to see the factors that are being weighed, or that were being weighed in Britain over the Brexit debate. Those who wanted to stay in primarily were motivated by economic reasons. They felt it would be better economically to stay a part of the European community. And with Brexit, both the European community and the United Kingdom will be negotiating a very rocky road economically. It will be a difficult road for them to figure. And the EU will be pressured to pull it together on their own terms more strongly, without Britain being a part. There was an article in the New York Times, and this was written actually before the referendum, on June 15th, entitled "Brexit Plan for the Financial World? Cross your fingers." Among those who manage gobs of money, the possibility that Britain might actually disavow the European Union seemed until recently like a remote and even outlandish possibility, unleashing anxiety and uncertainty throughout the global community. Angst has seeped into the calculations now as investors digest the possibility that the largest marketplace on earth may be days away from a messy alteration. And indeed, we've entered that period of time, but they call it a messy alteration. Whatever stories policymakers and business people tell themselves, the only certainty, according to the New York Times, is a surplus of uncertainty. How are we going to move forward and figure this out economically? How do we take those Jenga pieces out of this tower? How do we do that? It's an interesting conclusion that the article drew. Britain would remain a fully fledged member of Europe's marketplace for 2 years as it negotiated a new arrangement with the 27 remaining members of the Union. But if Britain fails to secure a deal after the vote to exit, how do you negotiate these deals? If you fail to negotiate a successful deal, commerce with Europe could be governed by the terms of the World Trade Organization, which gives member nations the authority to impose potentially steep tariffs on imports. And so they're talking about the very real possibility that Europe will again pull in and essentially penalize those who try to leave, like the UK. Those urging a Brexit insist Britain can negotiate a tailor-made deal. Many economists describe that notion as somewhere between fanciful and delusional. Eager to discourage other members from considering an exit, Europe would seek to ensure that Britain paid a price. That's the opinion of the New York Times. What's going to happen? Interesting to speculate, isn't it? Will, indeed, Britain have to pay a price? How will this impact? And will there be a strengthening of core constituencies within the European community? Let's turn our attention to Revelation 13 and Revelation 17. Now, those who chose to exit, we saw what those wanting to stay in the community did so primarily for economic reasons. Those that wanted to exit, they did so primarily motivated by immigration and security concerns. They felt that they could control their borders and their security better themselves. And it's interesting that with both the United States and Britain looking after their own immigration and security concerns, because don't we share those concerns? Isn't that a big debate and argument within the United States? How do we handle immigration? We're facing those same concerns. It's a huge issue in the political realm right now, in the election cycle. And with the United States and Britain choosing their own ways to figure out how to handle their immigration and security concerns, the EU is going to be pressured to deal with their needs to handle immigration and security concerns on their own and on their terms. In the article that we published June the 23rd on Life, Hope, and Truth, the British chose Brexit. Eric Jones, the author, said, "Today the citizens of the United Kingdom voted by a narrow margin to leave the European Union, a move stunning many in the UK, Europe, and around the world. Now that the decision has been made, a long process of negotiating the logistics and details of the British exit from the EU will commence. It still remains to be seen how this will truly affect the UK, EU, and global markets. This decision by the British people will possibly accelerate the European goal of developing an ever closer union. Bible prophecy reveals that a political and economic power will arise in Europe, and it will be formed by 10 nations or groups of nations that will give their power to a central political leader who will arise in the heart of the former Holy Roman Empire. While Europe will rise to greater power in future years, prophecy shows the British and the American nations will decline and suffer punishment for their national sins. We will strive to keep you abreast of prophetically significant developments. We are also in the final stages of preparing a new book on the topic of the identity of British and American peoples in prophecy. We will offer it on this site when it is complete. I know that they're looking forward to having the new booklet available by feast time, and I'm sure that it'll be a book that we'll all want to carefully take the opportunity to read. It's going to be quite a bit expanded from what I understand over some of the things that we have previously written on the subject. So keep your eyes open for that when it comes. But let's turn our attention to Revelation chapter 17. We're going to start reading in verse 1. Revelation 17, verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." So here's a woman identified as a great harlot. Scripturally, we recognize that a woman is a representation or pictures, it's symbolic of the church, or a church. And when we go back to Revelation chapter 12, we see that there was a woman who brought forth a man-child, and that woman obviously is representative of God's people, God's church, this woman. But here, in Revelation 17, we read not of, you know, that faithful woman, the church, but we read of a harlot, a false church, a false religious system. And one that, it says, sits on many waters, waters representing different peoples. So this is a powerful false religious system that has long deceived and ruled over numerous nations and peoples. Verse 2. With whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. The kings of the earth had a relationship with this harlot. It's an apt description of what we know historically as the Holy Roman Empire. There was a harlot-like relationship between there. They were both serving their own interests, and they came together to serve their own individual interests in uneasy unions of self-interest. But they were never really cooperative and nicey-nice to each other. They each had their selfish desires in mind, and it's when you look historically in the long history of the Holy Roman Empire, the kings allied with Rome and Rome allied with the kings in relationships that were mutually self-advantageous, of necessity, almost always uncomfortable and uneasy alliances, kind of like when Napoleon, rather than kneel before the Pope so that the Pope could crown him as the Holy Roman Emperor. No, Napoleon just grabbed the crown out of the Pope's hands and put it on his own head. That's kind of telling of the type of relationships that existed between the civil and the religious powers throughout the Holy Roman Empire. It was not exactly a loving relationship. And the inhabitants of the earth, it says, were made drunk with the wine of their fornication. Like during the times of the Inquisition, when the inhabitants of the earth suffered because of the fornication, because of the relationship between the civil powers and the religious powers. Rome ruled, but it was the authorities on the civil side that enforced so much of the Inquisition that just was devastating for so many. There's a reference in Revelation chapter 14. We can parallel here. Revelation chapter 14 and verse 8 speaks in similar terms. Revelation 14 and verse 8 says, "And another angel followed, saying, Babylon has fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." The wine of her fornication is not a pleasant thing. It's a horrendous thing that comes on the people as a result of this. Back then in Revelation 17, continuing in verse 3, "So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns." Now these ten horns are not the same ten horns that we read about in Daniel. Remember, there were seven horns in Daniel that were left once the religious small horn came into being. And those seven remaining horns of Daniel correspond with the seven heads of this beast, being described in Revelation 17. But on one of these heads, there are 10 horns. So we're introduced to this beast with 7 heads and 10 horns back in Revelation chapter 13. And so let's turn there and read about this beast. Revelation chapter 13. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. How many toes were there? Weren't there 10 toes in the image? And those 10 toes are what correspond with these 10 horns. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth was like the mouth of a lion. This is reflective of what we would have read in Daniel 7 about the beasts representing these various kingdoms or empires through history. And the dragon gave him his power and throne and great authority, and I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. And there has been a wound in the Roman Empire. People think it's dead. But it's not! The vision, the dream of Rome continues yet to this day and will be the motivating and the driving factor that ultimately sees Europe rise yet again. It was the dream of Hitler. Hitler was the Kaiser. Kaiser means Caesar, the emperor of the Roman Empire. We have seen the dream of Rome continue through history. It has been the inspiration of everything that has sought to unite Europe through history. And it will be yet again. Rome is not dead. So many will look and say, oh, Rome fell. But it didn't. I saw one of the heads as it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. The world will be in awe of what is yet to come. And so they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? You know, right now, the thought of making war with Europe is not... People don't think about that. Economically, they see the power of Europe. They don't see the power of Europe as a military one yet. But they will. They're going to get to the point where they're going to look at that power and say, who is able to make war with the beast? Right now, people look at the United States and say that. This is going to change. He was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months, or about 3.5 years. And then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. When this happens, the saints will be... It will be the time of Jacob's trouble. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. And he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity, but he who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. Verse 11, then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, and he spoke like a dragon. So just as we saw in Daniel the horns with another horn that came up, here in Revelation we see a beast and then another beast that arises. Just like in Daniel 17, we see a woman who rides a beast. We see this paralleling of two that come together repeatedly in all of these. And in this case, verse 11 in Daniel 13 says, saw another beast coming out of the earth that had horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon, dragon being Satan. This is a false religious beast. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast. He controls the authority of the first beast. And this is what we've seen historically has been the case with the Holy Roman Empire. This attempt to exercise control by and through the other power. And he causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. This is an unholy alliance between this beast, this horn, this woman, and that final beast power. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom, and let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. It is the number of a man. His number is 666. We have articles in Life, Hope, and Truth that address those subjects. I would just encourage you to read those if you have the desire to pursue that. Let's go back then to Revelation 17. Revelation chapter 17, picking it up in verse 4. This woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. On her name, on her forehead, a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. But the angel said to me, Why do you marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. Those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. So this time frame of this vision was during an interval, you could say, in the resurrections of this empire. Here's the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains, kingdoms, empires, on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. So when we're looking at this last resurrection, this last beast power, it won't last a long time. It'll be partly strong and partly weak. It's going to want to fracture, but it will have great strength for a short time. And the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seven and is going to perdition. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are just the final stage of this power. They are of one mind and they will give their power and authority to the beast and will make war with the Lamb. So this is a power that will actually fight Christ when Christ returns. And the Lamb will overcome them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. And he said to me, The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, tongues. And the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot and make her desolate and naked and eat her flesh and burn her with fire. So this alliance is going to turn on the woman ultimately. For God has put into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind, and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So there are a number of things that, as we read here, are yet to be fulfilled. How long will it take to bring them all about? I don't know. We don't know. But we do see the forces at work that are moving to bring them about. That we woke up and saw even just the other day on television. We've just seen a dramatic step in the direction of prophecy. There will be yet more dramatic steps that are to come. And when it all does come together, remember, they will wonder after the beast. Why will they wonder after the beast? Well, you know, Thursday morning when I turned on the news, there was no even knowledge of what was going on reflected. And then everybody was all wondering on Friday morning when all of a sudden, you know, Britain voted out. Well, there will be a similar type of dramatic wondering when all of these things come to pass. It shouldn't surprise us when it happens, but it will surprise many, and they'll wonder after the beast. They'll wonder after the power and the influence of the beast. Who can make war against it? Nobody can buy or sell without its approval. And they'll wonder over all of that power that it exercises, seeming to have come out of nowhere as a surprise, perhaps. Like, where did this all come from? How did this all happen? Because it will be a surprise to many. And the speed with which it seems to come on the scene, and with the ten giving power to it, and with the joining of efforts with the harlot all coming together at one time. The forces are at work to bring these things to pass. The forces are also at work to see the diminishing of power of the United States and Britain. But that's another story for another day. Those forces are also at work. But the people of God, Christ's little flock, we must stay faithful and we must stay strong and we must stay diligent and vigilant. The people of God must be doing the work of God. People of God have been called to a purpose, and we must be preaching the gospel. That's good news. The gospel of the kingdom, which is truly man's only hope, isn't it? The problems that are faced in this world are intractable. The only hope is Christ's return. That's the gospel and the good news, and a sure hope it is. The people of God must also be growing personally and individually and overcoming, and we must be becoming the bride that is without spot or wrinkle, that is ready to marry Christ at his return, ready to assume our place in the kingdom of God and the family of God with Christ at his return. I had a recent conversation this past week with somebody we were talking about, what does America need to do? We need to stop pouring money in this black hole of the Middle East. We need to get out of the Middle East, let things be in the Middle East, and just worry about defending our own borders. Just pour all of our money into homeland security, that's all. And we'll if terrorists want to come here, we'll stop them at the borders. Well, it's kind of good luck. I mean, certainly America is trying to do that. But does that mean that America has no interest or no business in being overseas, attempting to stop them where their headquarters are as well? We talked about the history of that, because certainly Europe, before Hitler, basically retracted and tried to protect their own borders. That didn't stop Hitler. It only made Hitler's power grow stronger, and the ultimate devastation that came about was that much greater. So ignoring the problem and just becoming defensive, is that going to stop the ideology and the growth of that ideology around the world? No, probably not. And ultimately, you have to admit that, yeah, that's really not a solution. But pouring money into the Middle East militarily, how do you battle an ideology? It's not like you can take over a capital city like you could have with Hitler. How do you fight that? He said that's not winnable. And he ultimately had to conclude that just becoming defensive is also not winnable. So he said, you know, this is an unwinnable war. And I said, yeah, bingo, you're right. It's not winnable. The problem is intractable, but the answer is not pour money, more money into the Middle East or you know, support Raytheon or what. The answer is Jesus Christ's return to this earth. The answer is the need to change the human heart and ultimately to lead the way to peace and the end of war. What other answer is there? We're seeing that. It is not in man who walks to direct his steps. History has taught us that, and current events teach us that. Even as we see the events Scripture has prophesied, all coming to pass, all taking place, let's keep our eyes on the prize. Let's press toward the goal of the high calling of God in Jesus Christ, as it tells us in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 14. And in that way, what are we doing? In that way, we are investing not in this world, we are investing in the kingdom of God, where moth and rust do not corrupt. We're investing in the true hope of our calling, the true hope of all of mankind. We're laying up a treasure in heaven and not on earth. You know, it's interesting. I started out by quoting from the Motley Fool investment advisors. And what did they say? Keep calm and invest on. Good advice for you and me. Just know where our investment is. Keep calm and invest on.